contain.
No, this is really great. I've been meaning to get you on for a minute now. Yeah, awesome, man. So how's it going?
It's good. LA's pulled off a little bit. I got my corn patch. Have you seen? I think I've posted this on Twitter a couple times, but I've got corn about 16 feet high.
That's awesome.
Project for the summer.
Wow. I've been really interested in minerals. That's like a big arc of the show, basically. And I had no idea you were so involved. Stuff I want to introduce. This is James Pogue. I'm sure a lot of people know who he is. He's a fantastic writer. He's written a lot of great stuff, most recently about his ventures in Central Africa in the CAR. And I really wanted to get into that because I think the mineral issues geopolitically, culturally, economically are going to have a massive impact on how we shape our views of society and monetary exchange and also commodities and value systems. Politics are so fucking weird and crazy right now. And this guy he knows a lot. He's been around a lot. He's actually walked the walk. So yeah, how's it going?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me. I'm glad we finally got to do this.
Yeah. It's been a long time in the making. Probably, I think we first discussed this like 2 years ago or something. So
that's true.
A lot has happened in 2 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, should I just start at the beginning with my mineral, mineral story?
Yeah.
So the funny thing is I'm not a geologist or a geophysicist or any kind of like mining know-how kind of guy. But apologies to anyone who's already heard this story. I feel like it's almost getting stale. But like, basically, I have this funny back history where I dropped out of college at McGill and rode freight trains around the country. And because I had gone to McGill in Montreal, I spoke French. And I kind of randomly lucked into a job with a crew of pilots and geophysicists doing essentially what is the first of the four steps of mining exploration. So, you have exploration, drilling, exploitation, shipping, whatever. You can go through the mining stages if you want. But the kind of preliminary thing is to make subsurface maps that are like inverse topographical maps with contour lines that show what are known as essentially anomalies. And so you'll have guys who are like, that's a damn good anomaly. Like, and you'll see it up on the wall, like if you go into any mining office or whatever. And this work used to be done just as a matter of interest. Like, it kind of developed in Canada because you had the technical know-how and you had this vast, largely unexplored, you know, expanse of crown lands where you could just be, you know, a 23-year-old pretty tough guy and put a magnetometer on your backpack and head off onto the Canadian Shield and explore. And so a lot of the sophisticated early geophysical techniques were pioneered by basically like young, foolhardy, like Canadian adventurer guys. And this eventually folded into a more efficient means of basically putting that same kind of equipment at much more sophisticated scales, combining it so you have magnetometers, gravimeters, Geiger counters, you can test for uranium, gold, water, whatever. And you can put this on a plane and fly at 500 feet above the deck and basically do large scale geophysical surveys. And people will pay millions of dollars for these because they help them identify where to drill. So I got hired basically as a cook for one of these crews doing like in a pretty small company. That's only $7.5 million. Contract with the Mauritanian government and with the big mining concern Rio Tinto. And kind of luck of the draw, I ended up getting elected crew chief because like no one wanted to do the job. So I kind of like ran the tail end of the project at 21, 24 hours drive from the nearest paved road. You know, like four planes, six trucks under my command. It was really like the absolute dream for a 21-year-old. And little did I know at the time, because geophysical maps don't really tell you what they're looking for. They just look for differences in density, differences in magnetism, that sort of thing, that this region was about to kick off into what is the largest gold rush in human history. And specifically that block became one of the biggest sort of centers of this new Sahara Sahel gold rush.
Wow. That's super fascinating. And it was Kinross. Was that the mining firm or?
Well, Kinross. So I didn't work for Kinross, but this will kind of set up like a little bit of the bifurcation that happens in Africa. So Kinross was the company that was developing a mine called Tasiast, which at the time was the largest gold strike in African history. It might still be. And Tasiast was off towards the coast of Mauritania, which is the only country. It's not fully within the Sahara, but it's essentially the only country fully within the Sahara in all of Africa. It's on the northwest coast of Africa. And Tasiast, we were working with the company that basically did the initial drilling of Tasiast, which was called Sahara Drill Corps, which is an Australian company that like people in Africa, there's a phrase that in Francophone Africa people use, which is bandits, like ce sont des bandits. And these were real like bandits. They're really like bad, fucked up Australian pieces of shit, like in a lot of ways. And they're really, really corrupt. Like one of them died of, he was drinking 24 beers a day, in the house that I was about to rent. And he tried to drink his 24 beers a day through about a malaria, and he just like died in the house. And that was like the only house in town to rent. So we had to rent the house that Robbie had died in. But Sahara Drill Corps, so they were, to continue this sort of story of how exploration works, they would take the geophysical maps and they would do the actual targeted drilling. So they were doing the targeted drilling for Tasiast. Kinross ended up buying Tasiast, spinning that into a $3.2 billion, like publicly held, publicly traded company on the TSX. Actually $7.2 billion. And so that became like an actual massive mine that got a lot of people very rich, and that kind of changed Mauritania's whole mining paradigm, because up until that time, they basically only had iron mines that were developed as major industrial centers. And Tasiast came in to kind of reframe everything around gold. But Tasiast doesn't employ that many people. And so gradually, bit by bit, as people discovered that there was gold in lots of other places too, like not necessarily places you would industrially develop, but just places that I could go out and find, like a guy in California in 1849, the whole country opened up to mining. And mining is now by far the largest employer, even though
Right.
most of those people work for themselves.
That's very fascinating. And, you know, we've spoken a lot about the Wild West and, you know, the sort of pre-Gilded Age of capitalism. And you've written about Bernard DeVoto, who I really interesting guy. You know, your kind of political evolution, because you started off as like an anarchist. I remember when I first talked to you, you were like, you were, I think, on the left, and now you're kind of, I mean, I don't know, you know, like who knows anymore what
Yeah, a
anything
matter of
is
no,
like.
I mean, let me speak to that actually, because my argument has always been, I've been sort of delving into this with some people recently, and my argument has always been that actually not like in one of these kind of like, oh, I didn't leave the left left me, or whatever. Not that. But my argument has always been that I actually just was always an anarchist. And I always, like, I was an anarchist in the sense of like, do you know who like Jim C. Scott is? Like the guy who wrote Seeing Like a State or Against the Grain.
No.
Oh, check it out. It's awesome. It's awesome. Because that's sort of the guiding light in my work on Mauritania. Because, like, I always thought that the American Project was essentially completely compatible with left-wing anarchism. Like, I was always an American patriot and a left-wing sort of like utopian
Yeah,
anarchist.
same.
Because I always felt like this was a project to devolve power to people. Jeffersonian democracy is a project of devolving power to people, of finding, for better or for worse, ways to interact with the land that are more meaningful than what we have. And again, for better or for worse, it's not to elide the mass killings of people as we moved across the continent, but it was also a project to essentially legalize barbarianism. This was a project to legalize pastoralism in the Western sort of open range sense. It was a project to legalize people like getting their own power from control of their own land, which is something that is basically unique throughout the entire world. And that is, to me, not at all incompatible with like the left-wing anarchism of these great thinkers. Like, you know, I was kind of buddies with David Graeber. I would disagree with him on some things, especially some of his later stuff, but like I would sh say basically I shared his worldview at 18 and I share his worldview now. You know what I mean? And so I don't really feel like I moved in any direction away from where I was. It's just, it's harder to talk about the pro-American stuff that I have, and like harder to talk about Jeffersonian democracy as actually like a good step in history without sounding like you're like off on some tangent on the right now. But I don't think I've actually changed.
No, I mean, I'm a Whitman
Yeah, exactly.
Jeffersonian Democrat, like 100%. I've always said that, you know. I've always actually considered myself a like left wing, but I am very, I think, you know, all of these strange internet, and one of the reasons, not to get off on a side tangent, but one of the reasons I was interested in your work on Africa is there's this notion of left-wing American patriotism that has, I think, very kind of ham-fisted views of geopolitics, stuff like, you know, just kind of overt Putin work, like, you know, like the tanky stuff. And I, you know, like, I'm really, like, don't get me wrong, like, I agree with a good amount of it, but there are things that I just, you know, like with Maoism, you can't overlook the mass cannibalism. You know, like there's just stuff that I just, you know, there are so many sort of like revisionist tendencies that I think people grasp onto with 20th century political ideologies. And I sort of see this as you know, various misreadings of Hegel. I think actually people say Byung-Chul Han is a pseud. He is the most accurate Hegelian read because he speaks of the dialectic of the spirit and the master-slave dialectic of the spirit, which is actually something that is incredibly American that Walt Whitman hinted on because he was a Hegelian as well. And so I'm sort of seeing like it's a really, really weird time. And I've been interested in Africa because of the coups and because Traoré seemed like a really interesting guy. He has sort of you know, I think there's a kind of romanticism of, I mean, obviously Thomas Sankara is this like incredibly romantic figure of like one of the really sort of positive revolutionary junta, like sort of left wing, but a bit trad junta leaders of the world. And then obviously he got disposed of very soon after, but there's something like intoxicating about that. But there's also the reality on the ground that has to do with jihadists and their battle with them, the Wagner group. You know, like, I'm interested in your perspective on all of this as somebody who's not just been sitting on the internet reading armchair theory, who's actually been there. So,
well, okay, so there's a lot to unpack there. Just to mention Sankara, because I think a lot of people sort of don't actually fully know his history. He's the guy who changed Burkina Faso from being what had then been the poorest country on earth, Upper Volta,
yeah,
into Burkina Faso, the land of upright men, or as the joke that often gets made is the land of erect men. And Burkina at the time that Sankara took over, was the poorest country on earth. And he refused to take money from the IMF. He planted like 10 million trees. He made the country food self-sufficient in the space of 2 years. He built hundreds of miles of railroad track by essentially mobilizing a mass political revolutionary movement to, you know, then develop Burkina's manganese, which is not a huge store, by the way, but their manganese kind of on their own terms. And there's a video of him that I always cite where he says, like, look, like, African elites will always, he skips this part, but I'll say it for him. Like, African elites are always trying to like skip steps in this sort of like long march of development, if you wanted to like adopt the kind of progressive liberal globalist worldview about how these things work, right? You kind of like, you don't really get to go from being Cote d'Ivoire to Singapore. Like, there are steps that you have to undertake on the way to get to that level of development. And his criticism of previous African elites was, on the one hand, they're either like corrupt and obtuse and have no real ideas and are just sort of like getting money from the French or international organizations, whatever, right? That's one option. Option two is like, they're trying, but they're not building the kind of like foundational structures that you need to actually be a self-sufficient nation and actually not be in these cycles of dependency, cycles of currency crises, cycles of all this sort of thing, right? And so Sankara would always say like, you know, we always sell out our attempts to develop ourselves for lipstick and champagne, which you can get in Paris. And he would say to Burkinabe, it's like, look, we're just not going to have this stuff. You're going to wear homespun cotton. Like, all of his government ministers had to wear Burkinabe made clothes. And it was a nationalist from the roots, but left-wing revolution, which like we sort of today, like that sounds like an oxymoron. But on the one hand, it was like very, very empowering for Burkinabe women. And he had this right. whole like sort of campaign against bad husbands and stuff. It was like the anti-bad husband campaign and stuff. But then on the other hand, it was an Africanist revolution. And in fact, like he correctly perceived that without it being an Africanist revolution, it actually couldn't work. Because if you tried to just suddenly jump into being like a baby imitation of Belgium, you don't have the stuff. You don't have the refineries that allow you. You don't have a tire factory. You don't have all this stuff that these countries had. And so you have to build that infrastructure bit by bit by bit by bit by bit. And it's a very long process, but you're still incrementally getting richer and you're building a foundation that would allow you to someday take your place amongst the independent nations of the world, which essentially most African nations and most, certainly basically all Francophone African nations were at the time not in independent in any meaningful sense.
Well,
right?
I mean, France just so deeply colonized them that this is kind of the argument I don't like from the right, is that this idea that they can't govern themselves. It's like, well, they haven't really had an opportunity to.
Exactly. And so that's false. Sankara, like, that's part of going back to this, like, who's right wing, who's left. Like, one of the things that just drives me crazy is like how quickly in like in post Elon Twitter era, like this kind of like meme of like black people can't govern themselves just has become such a thing that these dudes who know fucking nothing about this stuff are just completely convinced by now, because they just have completely memed themselves into believing this. And it's, I find it absolutely gross. And
I
like,
do too. Yeah, yeah.
It's just the energy, just to go off on this for a second, but like the energy these people are bringing to that stuff is like really crazy. Like you see them like retweeting like pictures of African food and being like, it looks like shit, like all that stuff. They're really, really obsessed with this stuff, as much as they may pretend that they're not, or like, oh, it's just the facts, it's just IQ stuff.
Yeah.
I do get really, really turned off and frankly disturbed by it.
I do too. I every time I look at X, it's disturbing. That's why I'm deactivating my account, because I can't. And also, it's like, if you're trying to make a case and you interview JD Vance for the New Right article, and it's like, you are actively harming whatever electoral movement that you're supporting, because they're associating you. Like, people see this stuff. And like, for example, mm-hmm. there are members of my family who are, you know, Trump voters and Trump supporters, and they're reading about people like in that sort of world on the kind of what you would say like dissident right. And they're freaked out. Like they're like, what is accelerationism? Like, who is Nick Land? This is really gross. Mm-hmm. Like, what is this like scientific racist stuff? Like, I don't want to have anything to do with this. It's having like a really negative effect on the supposed, on the one movement that validates them, it, you know, and gives them actually some bit of space within the information economy. They're doing incredible amounts of damage to that, just from a self-preservation standpoint alone. So,
yeah. And like, I don't know, I've really wrestled with this. I'm not, I won't use her real name because I'm not sure if she, but like with quote unquote Audrey Horne from Twitter, like who's a friend of mine. And like, we were talking about this, cause it's like, there was such, for me, I guess, like coming, I came to like Twitter and the dissident right, like not like joining it, whatever, but just in discovering what all these conversations were, I came to this stuff as like, oh, this is interesting. Like we are having discussions that are outside the bounds of like this kind of restrictive progressive liberal
right.
mindset
yeah.
that has, you know, sort of brain warped everyone since the end of the Cold War. And it felt very liberating, it felt very interesting. And so like, when I wrote that first New Right piece, like having never even heard the term dissident right until I sat down to start writing it, it was great because it was like my own process of discovery as I was doing it, right? And for you or me, who's like, you know, sort of probably pretty comfortable with fringe outside ideas and pretty comfortable with thinking that like somebody is not necessarily evil just because they're entertaining ideas that don't fit
right.
our political norms, you can kind of do that stuff and take it seriously and be interested in it. And then I guess now, like I'm having this kind of sudden moment where like everybody's revisiting that piece and finding all this stuff that I pulled out and just being like, what is going on? This is terrifying and insane. And I'm suddenly sort of seeing it through those eyes in a way I hadn't before. Cause I see stuff I found of JD Vance saying X or whatever, or stuff that he said to me. And I see it on Maddow. I see it in the New York Times. And you're like, oh, this is like not ready for prime time. Like none of this is. And I think they kind of memed themselves into thinking that they were. Like, I think if you look at the repeated Blake Masters stuff, it's like this stuff is not translated. You know what
no.
I mean? Like it's almost like they're still talking to a Twitter echo chamber that like even you can do on Tucker, because Tucker's sort of in the same echo chamber, but like, you do it on the local news and it's like, wait, we have not brought America along with this. And then you add in like the just swelling and swelling gleeful racism that like, correct me if I'm wrong, but I didn't feel like was as much of a thing before, maybe just because it would get you banned if you did it before. And now
I think people had eyes on them because there was such a concerted effort to, you know, in a very corrupt manner, dispose of Donald Trump as president. I mean, you know, like,
yes.
You can't deny the fact that the machinations of whatever this kind of deep state, cabalist, you know, hegemonic force that had sort of coalesced and came together. Like, you can't deny the reality that there was something very anti-democratic about that happening. But because of that, people kind of had to be on their best behavior. Now it's full barbarism because now that Biden has power, but it's like, well, if an election's coming up, and I'm speaking just purely objectively, I'm not trying to say one side or the other, just from a strategic point of view, in an election season, you don't want to ramp that up. You want to dial that shit down because this is a massive strategic error. I just think it's like very, very strange and it's really fucking gross. And I don't, and again, this is turning off Republicans. Like, the, you know, their boomers are reading this shit and they're like, this freaks, and this is the demographic of people who vote. They're freaked out by it. They don't want to associate with this. And the whole self-memeing thing, I think, is big. It was big. They're doing it with, like, coconut pilled and all this other stuff. And I just don't think memes matter that much. Like, I just really, I'm not, I don't know.
I think they matter in the sense of, like, I mean, I don't know. I in so much as I remain, like, basically, like, a sort of mainstream political journalist in some sense. Like, I still write for places that it would be classed as mainstream. Like, I still feel like Twitter remains the ultimate editor of American media. Like, I think that's probably going to stop being true after this election, but for now it still is. And, like, I think memes matter in the sense that, like, all of a sudden the people I work with have been memed into believing that Kamala is cool and has the mandate of heaven, just as people on the right were really, I mean, we can go into this. This is a whole other conversation, but it has bearing on like the, what we're actually talking about in terms of Africa, because I think people on the right for a long time kind of memed themselves into believing that they had the mandate of heaven and that it was like this one long upswing up to this hero moment of Trump almost getting shot, where like Project 2025 is coming in. We're going to wrap up the empire. Like, it is a new American dawn. It is a new American nation. Like, we've got an army of boys in polo shirts and blue blazers who are going to come in and break this thing. We are ready. And like, they just kind of meme themselves into thinking the election was already won. I mean, that's part of the story of JD getting picked. Like, obviously some of that had to do with, I mean, some of that had to do with Trump feeling overconfident after the shooting and after the success of the RNC. But like, part of it is actually, I can say for a fact, like, he was basically already decided before that. And that was because they wanted somebody who was going to come in and be a warrior and break the empire and stuff. Like, that's real.
Wow. That's why that could have fooled me. I was totally like, this is a last minute pick. Like, this is just,
well, I was with him. I was with him like 6 days before and it seemed pretty in the bag. He didn't say that, but it just, that was the vibe. It was very much the vibe. I wish I could quote this. There's so many good quotes from that conversation, but it was off the record. It felt so relaxed that I didn't even bother asking about it. It felt just sort of like the energy was, this is probably going to happen. And if it doesn't, it'll be all right, but it's probably coming down. And like, I've talked about this, apologies to anybody who already listened to me on Good Old Boys, but yeah, like the immediate freak out at that moment when he got picked, and the RNC was happening and it was the mandate of heaven. Trump just almost died. Now he's back alive. He has the ultimate coolest picture ever taken in America, all this stuff. The idea there really was like, we are going to come in and we're going to change everything. Like, this nation is going to be renowned. This nation is not going to be an empire anymore. And people started calling me from all over the world being like, what is JD's foreign policy? Because that was the scary thing to them. That is the scary thing to them. It goes to your point about a real, very energetic, very powerful deep state that went to war with Donald Trump in 2016. That stuff is completely real.
Yeah.
And the terror, the real terror, is like, what happens if somebody says we're going to pull the plug on NATO, which is not going to happen. But like, what happens if America, you know, even just little stuff like slashes USAID, because people's jobs are at stake. Like, what happens if they gut the top half of state, which they sort of halfway did and halfway reorganized and just left it in chaos? What if they really reorganized state? What if they really reorganized like both the internal and external security services? Like, whose jobs are getting lost, whose contracts are getting lost, which think tanks are going to get, because the German Marshall Fund, I don't know how that gets funded, but like, are those people still going to have jobs? Like, that's where your terror comes from. And I think JD was like sort of the walking impersonation of, or the walking personification of like what that terror represented. And it went wild, in European capitals there for a minute, because they were convinced Trump was going to win. They were convinced that JD was going to be the Dick Cheney behind the throne, that, Ukraine was like, Russian tanks were going to be in Kharkiv tomorrow. Like, all of this really like flew into panic. And then somehow the left sort of memed itself into being like, no, we have the minute of it. And it's like happening so fast that I found it almost like kind of terrifying for us as a nation, like to have people go so quickly from like, this one outcome is assured and we are ready for it or terrorized by it, to a complete 180 in the space of no time and on the basis of essentially no policy changes. Like, that is a terrifying
It
thing
is.
for a global empire to like have as directing force. And I would argue that that directing force is more memes than it is even the deep state. Like, because these people operate in a cloud of ideas.
But I think the fog of ideas is kind of a, I mean, it is what it is. You know, I think now that the information economy has become so superfluous, our reliance on data and statistics and information as, you know, no, is sort of like no new revelations are able to come to light because it's just all so superfluous. I think that we're going to be less reliant on paying off Intel, for example. So, or like paying for data services from foreign countries, for example, like maybe Israel. I just don't think we need any more intel. I think people are now sort of like, well, what is the material basis? Where are things materially grounded and where is that taking place? Because that's going to reshape the global economy. Like Joseph Schumpeter never went anywhere. Like the Kondratiev waves, those are very, very real and they're being picked up by China, for example. You know, China is doing this whole Shenzhen market thing where they're basically injecting forms of economic chaos in a very sort of classically neoliberal Schumpeterian way to gamify what we're going to do. Now we're sitting there stuck on shit that doesn't even fucking matter, talking about, you know, coconut trees and picture. It's like, I just think we're in a really dangerous place precisely because we're not focused on the policy that's going to place. And I think that goes to the American experiment. Like I'm unabashedly pro-America, you know, 100%. Nobody will like that is something I'm very stubborn on. But the way that I think, especially the right, they're going in this very sort of anti, like feudal direction where they think that we can simply just dominate people because, again, the mandate of heaven and the memes make us believe we're superior to them organically. But that's throughout history, we've shown that's not the case. And especially in Central Africa, when you have such a big problem with ISIS and 5G war, it's obvious that these forms of insurgencies are not going to go anywhere. So I want to hear a little bit about that because you've been on the ground and what's the situation with ISIS over there?
Well, so how far shall I cut back? When I was in Mauritania, let's see this. Like, when I was in Mauritania, I was there basically at the exact, not basically, I was there at the time that an organization called the GSPC, the Club Salafiste Prêche et Combat, which had been an Algerian rebel group, spinning off of, again, the sort of long tail of empire, spinning off of the Algerian Civil War that began in 1993 when the Salafists won free and fair elections in Algeria, and were denied essentially by the US and France, and of course, Algerian military government, which they backed, they were denied the chance to take power. And so they took to the communes and they fought. And they fought an incredibly brutal civil war that people have largely forgotten. But the GSPC morphed over time. A lot of its leaders became people who, like, if you were into kind of, you know, whatever, OSINT or counterterror news or whatever back in the 2000s, like, names you would know, like Mokhtar Belmokhtar, which like Mr. Marlborough, and I could go down this whole Abu Zaid, all these guys, they became essentially like smuggler warlords on the model. And this gets to what we were sort of talking about before, where everything in the US is like fake. Like, we have basically, when you cut your currency off from being tied to energy or resources, like, your whole society becomes at risk of becoming fake, because you're like, history doesn't matter, resources doesn't matter.
Right.
We can print money. Like, we live in an American dreamscape that is like far more fake and insane than the dreamscape of like SoCal in the 60s or whatever, like, oh, progress. Like, at that time, the dreamscape of like American infinite growth and like, you know, all this petroleum backed energy and, you know, massive expansion of our continental empire was on some level like not completely fake, like, because it was all tied to like, we're paying for stuff with money we have. And we stopped doing that after the 70s. And we started to live in a world where like literally stuff like trans-Saharan trade routes, like the most real stuff in the history of the humanity, like, you're going to link somehow Black Africa with the Mediterranean, and people are going to get rich doing it because there's stuff that has to get from one place to another. Like, Americans sort of like started to think stuff like that wasn't real. And in Africa, where it is extremely real, these guys are getting crazy rich, moving guns, drugs, people, stuff like this, right? They're starting to buy politicians in Northern Mali. They're building up their power. There's only like 1,000 of them at the time in the actual Al-Qaeda branch that the GSPC became. But, you know, they had the ability to rock the Mauritanian state to the point that, like, you know, soldiers were getting killed all around me. My hotel got shot up. I was staying at this place called the Casablanca, which shared a wall with the Israeli embassy. And there was an assault allegedly on the Israeli embassy. That wasn't my impression, but I don't want to get killed for talking about this. But like, a bunch of Westerners got, you know, like, shoved on the ground. I missed it by like a few hours. There was like shrapnel in the courtyard, like burning thatch, cars all shot up. And eventually, like, Mauritania had to cut a deal with Al-Qaeda. Like, eventually, they found it in Osama bin Laden's papers. Like, they started paying them €20 million a year just to like leave them alone. And after Gaddafi fell, the Tuaregs in the north of Mali, who at the time were sort of like vassals of Al-Qaeda, for a lot of them were, because they didn't really have any way to produce hard currency income.
But now they're enemies with Al-Qaeda, right?
Yes.
Quasi.
But also, I mean, importantly, goes to this point, now they have gold.
Right.
So like, now they have like their own external, and like, they have tacit support of outsiders and things like that. It's a little different. But at the time, like, their guy was Gaddafi, who we overthrew. And so they take all these guns, you know, they take Stinger missiles and stuff from Gaddafi's arms dumps. And these guys are hard-bitten desert warriors fighting against the Malian conscript army. And they join up with Al-Qaeda. And in 2012, they sweep towards Bamako. And it is only by French intervention that they were stopped, because they are highly, highly capable people, as you can see by the fact that they just killed 84 Wagner guys. Now, a full-on decade and a half later, they're still fighting. They're still very, is this an English word? Redoubtable? And so, to get to where I was building up to on this, this becomes the kind of like basic geopolitical fact from which all others would flow in Africa north of the equator, where you had all of a sudden a kind of like stew of either jihadist groups and smugglers and people who were outside of the control of what you might call the Western security umbrella because they were, you know, Islamists or something like that. And you had people who had never been organically integrated into states, such as Westerners tried to design them because they were herding peoples like the Tuaregs. So that's a sort of different, and that's a sort of like more traditional, almost like equatorial African, like sort of warlordism. Like if you look at North, like the interior of Northern Africa, like every single conflict is between central states and herding peoples, or between settled farmers and herding peoples. It's not even, it sounds like a joke, but actually break it down. Even in Sudan, the Janjaweed were fighting Darfuri settled farmers. The Janjaweed were, you know, camel raising, cattle raising Arabs. This rule holds true everywhere from the Central African Republic, where, and we'll go into this, I guess, but the Central African Republic, which is largely jungle, but where the rebels always come from Chad. They're always mercenaries coming from Chad and like the Sahel and the sort of more raiding, the traditional roots, yet again, of slave raids, because a lot of the history of Equatorial Africa is herding Arabs, roving mercenary type mobile peoples coming down into the jungles and capturing lots of black people to sell on the East African slave markets up until the 20th century. That continued to go, and sort of we lose that because it sounds politically incorrect to say that a lot of the trade was Arab too. But long story short, the Malian situation began to spread, and it spread to Burkina Faso, it spread to Niger, it spread to now Benin, Togo, Ghana. Nigeria has its own version. Again, in large part shaped by this kind of pull, herding people, fighting Hausa people. A lot of that gets sort of elided in international media because it's confusing. But this is what I'm building up to. These are conflicts essentially that have at their base the age-old conflict of like who gets to control territory for which base alimentary purpose. Who gets to control territory to like decide we're going to use this to raise cattle, we're going to use this to irrigate and make farms? Because as the Sahel is getting hotter, literally, it is making these conflicts, these age-old conflicts, much hotter. And you will start to see this getting worse and worse and worse throughout the world.